So let's say hypothetically you were a criminal. What kind of
Hypothetically,
crime?
yep, hypothetically, sure. Thanks, Kyle.
Yeah. Okay. Hypothetically, yeah. I mean, this is going out to the public, right? So everything that we say here is alleged. So yeah, if you were into crime and that's how you made your living, what kind of crime do you think you would be? Like a smuggler? Do you think you would be a cat burglar? Assassin for
I would
hire?
100% be a fence or a go-between. I don't want to touch anything, plausible deniability. I will just get two people to shake hands and do their thing. I will
Middleman,
take
all right.
I want the 10% finder's fee, and I can live off of that just comfortably.
Like no one truly knows what you look like and what your real name is. You are just like in the shadows in the background.
Yeah, and I've got some experience scheduling like 14 fucking people who just do not want to give me any sort of like regular time frame. So where everything is shifting all the time and no one can agree on what we're doing. So like I feel like I'm uniquely suited for being a go-between or a middleman.
Fair.
All right.
I would it would have to be something to do with booze, like
A bootlegger.
yeah, like shifting booze, bringing booze across the border that shouldn't go across the border, probably wine and moonshine and
I can just picture
all right.
Casey standing over a toilet just making wine.
Wearing a pinstripe suit with a fedora.
Yeah. What about you, Kyle?
Oh, what would I be? I feel like I would definitely be something involving costumes. You know, I wanna dress up. I wanna have a disguise kit for every day. Wear a
You don't need to
prosthetic
be a
nose.
criminal to do that.
No, but it would give me an excuse.
You could
You
just
know,
be a cosplayer.
I could.
So like to basically to be like a con artist kind of thing.
Yeah, con artists would be good. Oh
Yeah.
yeah, actually, you know what? That's the one. Con artist.
Because they need disguises because they're
Yeah.
gonna bamboozle every day.
There you go. I'm gonna build grannies out of billions.
I want you guys to know that I'm so happy none of us went with a violent crime because I'm looking at the list of the other hosts and it's terrifying what they would say. Absolutely terrifying.
You're welcome. I just went with alcohol.
As we usually do.
Maybe the more fun question would have been, what do we think everybody else would do?
Oh man, I'm gonna go to jail for slander.
Yeah. That's a whole podcast episode.
Yeah, that's my real crime that I commit is just absolute slander and libel against everyone I know. So.
Well, luckily that's just a civil crime, so you know.
Not with me, it's pretty uncivil. Hey, all right.
Welcome to the It's a Mimic podcast, where you never know what you're going to get.
Welcome back to It's a Mimic, where you never know what you're going to get. Today, we're continuing our discussion on DM tips in Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition. I'm Adam, and with me today are Casey and Kyle. And this episode is called Environments. When downtime is town time, you found time to fuck around time.
In this episode of the It's a Mimic podcast, this panel of Dungeon Masters will be wrapping up the conversation on downtime activities that you can add into your games if you want to spend more time role-playing in town.
So besides the rogue, barbarian, and warlock, which class do you think is the most likely to regularly commit crimes?
Okay, all right. So we're just going to talk about crime this whole episode then. Not where I thought we were going with the breakdown, but here we are. Okay. Let's roll initiative.
Should have seen this one coming though.
One.
Ooh, five.
Oh, nine. All right.
Starting off strong.
Which one do I think would regularly commit crimes? You know what? Paladin, because nothing is standing in the way of that oath, right? I think of it more as, you know, what is the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law?
Ah, fair. Well, I thought a bard immediately. They're just gonna talk their way through shit, and if that means lying, getting themselves into some illegal shit, they will do it.
I feel like the bard is a perfect like decoy or lookout, or like definitely on the team.
Yeah.
I'm going to just be honest here and say that I have never met a sorcerer that has not committed some sort of crime. Every sorcerer I've ever met. And I think it's just like the chaotic nature of the class, as well as the like high charisma, the high constitution, so they know they're gonna, you know, make it through. But also, it's right in, it's built into the class. It's not my fault. This is just happening. This is all outside of my control. And I think that when you build a character around that idea, you're going to just be a little bit more murder hobo-y, especially if your name is James, then you're just literally casting fireball at everything you can find. So
oh my god, I don't know how that happened.
Everyone just was suddenly exploding. I don't know. My genetics. I can't help it.
I'll remember that if I ever play a sorcerer.
You being chaotic is absolutely fucking terrifying, because I saw you chaotic with Acra. And that I feel like was the tip of the iceberg, because you were leaning more into the comedy and evil a lot of the time instead of just the I'm going to decimate this village.
Yeah. So she didn't quite get to be able to do that, though she wanted to.
And Casey, now that she's a villain, she will.
Oh yes, she has by now.
All right, let's cut to an info break.
We previously covered quite a bit in our discussion on Dungeon Master Tips in 5th edition. For all those episodes and more, you can follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and dozens of other podcast apps. And if you'd like to support us, you can donate through the website, check our store, or join our Patreon and get access to other episodes and series. If you'd like to pay for some ad space on It's a Mimic, or just shout out to a friend, please reach out to us through our email and website that are listed in the show notes below.
Before we get into it, I just want to say thank you to Alan for being our latest Patreon subscriber. This week on the It's a Mimic podcast, we are still trying to recover from that 2-week unexpected hiatus that we were forced to take. But what that means is that this week you can expect chaos. Pure chaos. But for now, let's get back to the episode. All right, so we are rounding up the end of the downtime activities. A lot of these are still considered to be variant rules or just like tips and tricks and stuff. But there's also a lot of, there's so many variant rules, so many to go through. And we have done many, many episodes that have included this option here or that option there. And we're just kind of rounding out the rest of the ones now. And I didn't know how to bring all these together into one cohesive theme, because it's mostly crime. But we're going to start off with a little bit of law and order. Because we've got variant rules from the DMG that are actually built around the idea of renown. And I've spoken about this on a couple of previous episodes, but it's been a couple of years. And it's worth bringing up again, because I think since then, we've had the Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica come out, which has got a whole bunch more insight on how to use this. So renown is essentially just a variant rule from the DMG that tracks a numerical value, which is going to indicate your reputation with a specific organization, cult, guild, faction, what have you. But why would you bother? Why would you bother to get into this? Well, the way that it lays it out is, this is for, first of all, organized dungeon masters. If you think that this is too much math, then you're right. If you think this is the right amount of math, then you're right. This is clearly subjective about whether or not you would pick this at all. Because I was even toying with the idea of, hey, this would be really good for our campaign. And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized that this is too many numbers that I've got to follow. And it's going to gamify social interactions in such a way that it's going to be less organic at our table. So I wouldn't. But why should you? Well, you not only have some sort of mechanic that tracks how to get in good with NPCs, but an increase in renown might grant access to information, more powerful NPCs, favors, fame among the organization's members, and even resources for the future. It's up to the DM to determine what these perks might be, but they should probably be different for each organization. There's also a brief mention in the intrigue section of the DMG about how renown might grant advantages in some social situations, depending on whether or not people like you or your faction. It applies to each separate faction or organization independently. So you can track the player's standings with different factions throughout your campaign. There's actually a pretty decent example of this in the back of the Tyranny of Dragons. I think it's Horde of the Dragon Queen does this, but it might be Rise of Tiamat. One of them tracks all of the different factions in Waterdeep, and you can do things, or as you make different decisions throughout the campaign, you'll become better standing, you'll get in better standing with them, or you'll drop in reputation, and it will impact how they interact with you, you know, in the rest of the game. So the idea here is that for each organization, your characters have a number that can go up or down and grant potential perks for reaching different milestones during the campaign. It's handed out like you would hand out experience, but only if circumstances require. The characters start at zero, and after certain milestones are achieved, like completing missions or quests for the organization or impacting their wants and needs in a favorable manner, the characters can gain 1 point of renown with that faction. If they do something particularly special or really, really public, they might even go up 2 points. A simple disagreement isn't enough to lose renown. Once you gain it, it's hard to lose it. But if you do egregious actions that defy the organization, that might make you lose renown, maybe even down to zero. But the Sorry, go ahead, Kyle.
I was going to say Fallout, the video game, has a similar mechanic where there's like a bunch of different factions all working either together or against each other. So if you did one mission for one faction, your renown with another faction would go down if they were enemies to you as well.
I really like that, but you would have to... Look, I homebrew a lot, right? So this is all well and good for games like Waterdeep, the Waterdeep games and stuff, where you run into four or five different factions. But in our homebrew, we're running into a new organization. There's a new guild we've got to go deal with. All of the farmers in the north part have unionized, and so you do a mission for them, and like there'd be so fucking much to track. And we're consistently crawling across the whole map. So you're going to new towns with new factions, and so it would be like every one of them, like your faction is going up significantly, and you've just got like a plus one or a in all of the others, and sometimes they drop, and it would be so much for me to fucking keep track of. Right. So, yeah. And then I know that we would start every session with Dan and Charlie looking at the like scale that I would have to have going, how did we lose one in that one again? And someone else going, I don't remember. Let me check my notes. And then, and our note taking is notoriously like,
what do you mean?
So anyway, actually I got to say Casey's note taking is the best out of all of them. Dan's is hilariously bad. So
he tries so hard though.
My favorite is Charlie says, hold on, I don't remember which book I wrote it down in. And then he flips for 45 minutes and then goes, it says here, we have to go talk to the man in the red cape. Thanks, Charlie. So.
Sorry, yeah. Does he take notes over like multiple books or like he can't find one for one session? So he brings another one.
It's a little of both, but also on top of that, you know, most people have like their binder or their notebook that is dedicated to it.
Yeah.
Charlie has three or four little flip books that could fit in your pocket that he keeps in his DM or in his D&D bag. And so he's consistently just grabbing the nearest one and it's infuriating. The man is pure chaos. Anyway.
He should get diagnosed for ADD because that is...
The diagnosis is just messy.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with renown, one of the big perks and the thing that I think draws most people to it is the fact that you can gain ranks. If the party members are actual members of a guild or organization in question, they might be able to gain ranks within that organization. The Dungeon Master's Guide has example ranks for some of the more prominent Waterdeep factions, like the Emerald Enclave, the Harpers, and the Zhentarim, among others. And the ranks listed are gained at level 1, 3, 10, 25, and 50. The idea here is that if you're not part of a faction, you start at level 0. You can join when you reach level 1 of renown. At that point, you get your first rank because you are a member. And then shortly thereafter, you prove yourself, and then it's a long, slow climb up the ranks from there. It's stated that these are examples and that you can set the levels at whatever you would like in order to make your game flow more smoothly. So it doesn't have to be 1, 3, 10, 25, 50. It could be 1, 5, 15, and so on and so forth. So the higher the renown and rank, the more Dungeon Masters are encouraged to shift general attitudes of member NPCs toward being friendly or even helpful. But there is a note that says that not all NPCs are guaranteed to feel that way toward the players. Some may even resent the players raising in ranks. So it's up to you as the DM. Characters with higher ranks might be able to command a small army, delegate simple missions to underlings, or get access to magic items that belong to the organization. These are some of the incentives for trying to climb these ranks quickly. There are also more renown rules. Some of them are later in the DMG under the section downtime, where there's a mechanic that says that if a character takes their current level of renown, multiplies it by 10, so if you've got 4 renown, now it's 40, and then you spend that number of days socializing and just helping the organization in small ways during downtime, and then they should be able to gain a single point of renown up to the next level. So after 40 days, you go up to level 5. This is just kind of the passive background shit, because you should be gaining renown by completing quests and doing shit that takes 1 day or 2 days, right? In the Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica, all of these rules are stated again because it is so important that the players in that realm, in that campaign setting, are members of guilds. Not everyone in that world is, but most people are connected or a member of the guilds. One of the things that's pointed out is that you can't have ranks in two guilds at the same time, but you can sometimes gain renown with other guilds, which gets you contacts, favors, and other things, like an audience with a high-ranking member of another guild, or information toward quests that might positively impact both guilds. There is mention that gaining a certain amount of renown doesn't automatically come with a promotion in rank, but it might let a character apply for a higher position, because job application is what I want in my D&D. Also, different guilds have different hierarchies, and it's implied that not all guilds promote its members at the same speeds. Also, salary is finally mentioned, although it is brief. This doesn't actually put liquid funds or gold pieces into the player character's coin purse, though. Instead, it just lets you bump up to a general level of lifestyle as described in the player's handbook, and it's simply maintained at no cost to the character. So you go from being poor to being comfortable to being moderately wealthy all the way up. So you're just getting better rooms at the inns, and you're getting better meals and soft social perks, like people will take note that you walk in your fancy clothes and shit like that. Again, it's mentioned that at higher level, members with larger ranks or bigger ranks can delegate things and give tasks to lower ranked members, but now it also says that the guild is always watching, and if you abuse your position, it can be taken away. There's information about the different kinds of members of guilds too. If you're having trouble kind of fleshing out the different kinds of NPCs, it goes into how there are 4: loyalists, opportunists, rebels, and anomalies. Loyalists are the diehard fans of the guild that have bought in wholeheartedly. These are like, no one's a part of Greenpeace unless they want to fucking be a part of Greenpeace, right? Like, no one's there for the money. They're there for the love of the cause. I'm not going to get into my thoughts on Greenpeace, but, you know, when we come to activism, there people are there for the reason, right? Opportunists are in it for the perks. The book makes it sound like these people are selfish, but honestly, that just sounds like every non-business owner that I've met in the fucking capitalist world we live in, because we got to make money to get the nice things. So that's apparently means that we're all opportunists, and I'm okay with that.
I imagine rebels, that's like nepotism too.
Yes, like, there's also, yes. Rebels are members who use the guild resources to accomplish things outside of the guild's natural structure or goals, like using a mercenary guild's resources to do good in a community, or using the position as a town guard to intimidate and bully some citizens. These are still members of the faction, but they are not necessarily going to be doing exactly what the guild wants. And the last one is anomalies, which are strange and unique members of the guild whose class and race don't seem to jive particularly well, like having the only Minotaur wizard in a wizard's enclave, or a warlock who joins a squad of commandos. Like, it doesn't necessarily fit at face value, but there's no reason why they can't do that. It's also got some pretty strict rules about changing guilds. Like, if you swap organizations, your renown with the original organization drops to 0. and you start at one with the new guild. Doesn't matter what you've done before, you're starting at the bottom floor. Now, if you want to get deep into the idea of renown, reputation, and rank, I suggest picking up Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica, because all 10 guilds come with a background option that includes a unique background feature, ideals, traits, bonds, and flaws tables for members, example ranks, all sorts of inspirations for interacting with other guilds, and I cannot stress how much those background features are so interesting and unique, because they all tie into how these unique factions work. So if you're not into Ravnica, if you can find it on like a cheap bundle on D&D Beyond, this is a good place to go if you're looking to explore this side of the game. The one thing,
honestly, it sounds like L5R campaigns.
Yeah,
that was what I was gonna say. Somebody who's moving from L5R to this, it's like if you add this into your game, they'll be like loving it.
Yeah, the only thing that's missing is like an honor scale, right? But it's easy enough to add that, because those are variant rules that we've covered in a previous episode as well. So there is honor and sanity and everything else you can. Fuck, you could have a whole new character sheet of additional variant rule options. It's nuts. So the one thing that I want to point out is that not all guilds have to be mutually exclusive, even though it says that in Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica. For example, a monk might have like 5 renown with their monastery before they went off into the world, but is now joined with a mercenary guild simply to help escort a caravan to the far side of the world, and then ended up gaining the basic level of rank with the mercenary guild to get them into places. But things went off the rails, and they ended up having to join a traveling circus to navigate the backwater villages of a strange new kingdom. So they've got a couple of ranks in that. They could absolutely be a member of each of these organizations and maintain their ranks and reputation in each, while also becoming locally famous with other factions, and it's not going to reduce their renown with the others. Additionally, if I'm going to use these rules, I would also include a generic like public renown as well for the characters. It doesn't include rank, but it lets you track how the general populace in different locations feel about the party members. In our campaign, Dan's character is fucking famous, and it keeps coming up, and it'd be cool to be able to track that for him. I might even include a version of this, which could be like an infamy scale if you are dealing with like black marketers and shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if all of this feels too convoluted, it might be worth it to just track some of these for the party in general instead of for all of the separate characters individually, because a lot of the time they do move and act as a group. I very rarely, short of rogues, I very rarely see a wanted poster with only one face and name on it. It's usually the whole fucking party, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's what I have for renown. Let's grab dice, because I got a couple of questions.
Oh boy. 6.
3.
Uno.
God, we suck at dice today. This does not bode well for D&D later, Casey.
At first with 6? Yeah, let's get the bad rolls out here, though. Let's just do that.
How do you feel about the renown rules and ranks and reputation and all that?
I can see how certain players, depending on their role, might get a bit fixated on this, and then try and divert focus to, hey, I'm trying to build ranks in this, we're gonna stay in this town for a week, whereas other ones are like, we need to move on, like we gotta go on the road. That's gonna be me.
Yeah, that's you.
Be like, let's move on. So I think you have to kind of, like, I think it's a great option to have. And yeah, like, Kyle, I'm right with you there on the L5R. That was just screaming in my brain while you were talking, Adam. So it absolutely has its place. I think it could get too complicated. So you have to, like, be very clear as a DM on how you're going to use this. But like, we've used this essentially with, like, we've created a name for our group in our current campaign, and we are trying to build a good reputation for ourselves, being like, yes, we're associated with these good guys, we're good guys, and like walking around, it's like, I don't know if you've heard of us, but so we're trying to do this. So you could add some sort of renown and rank system with us just having that reputation, or that while we're moving around the realm. Yeah.
For our campaign, it's been very soft, because I didn't want, if I say you can get up to like a maximum of 50 and then you get the maximum rank, you damn well know Dan and Dave are going to fixate on that. And Charlie's going to keep half an eye on it all the time anyway. And Mieka's going to go, what kind of perks can I get with this? And
what's
so
in it for me?
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Megan's current character could not give less of a fuck about this, right? So it's easier for us to just go soft rules instead of hard and fast rules. So I definitely hear what you're saying. Kyle, how do you feel about this?
You know, I think it's a cool mechanic. I think I would play it differently depending on what kind of campaign that I have, right? I might institute it a little more if it's a very zoomed out campaign, right? If we're going over long periods of time where it's like, okay, what are you doing in the next 3 months kind of thing?
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't tell players what their rank is at any given time to avoid the kind of power gaming where they're like concentrating too much on it. I would probably try to make it a more passive understanding or try to allude to their increased respect for people kind of non-verbally. I wouldn't go, you have 29 renown. I'd be like, yeah, these people look upon you with awe or whatever. Right. And I would also probably not have it for everybody, right? Like, okay, you're working for this one particular guild. That's all you really have to worry about, right? That's, you're working for them.
I like the idea of having this on the inside of your DM screen with like two or three factions. And those are the only ones that we're tracking it for, because I'm doing this all with soft skills anyway, right? So keeping it a secret. And then when I see them, you know, I'm counting a little tracker and it goes up and up and up. And then when I see them get to a certain point, I go, okay. Or they've done something particularly heroic. They've saved the mayor's daughter from the whatever. Then maybe only then they get a medal and a title and a rank increase, or, you know, they have a meeting with the leader of the guild or the next higher up or something. But that's just a mechanic for me to track their shit. And honestly, I can do that anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's how you would probably have more success, is just having it behind the scenes ongoing. It's a lot more work for your DM, though. Just another thing.
The other thing that I would probably use something like this for is Call of Cthulhu, where you are dealing with, when we played, we were crawling across Europe and there was no permanency whatsoever. But if you were in an area where you had to get in good with the bank or with the library or the, you know, political archives in DC or like whatever it is, this might be how you attract this shit as because there's a lot of zooming out. And what do you do today or this week in Call of Cthulhu? So I could see a mechanic like this working very well for investigators.
Mm-hmm.
And the more renown that you get, the more the cult becomes aware of you, right?
Yeah.
So there'd be a danger for that as well, which is the other, like, that's my last thing. That's the thing I'd bring up, is there should be a downside to becoming more famous. If you are one of the like mass generals or whatever, expect assassins to come in the middle of the night at least once, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and we have a lot of these that, like, lots of the ones we've been talking about have the complication mechanic. So this one, that's essentially that.
Yeah. Do you guys have, I'm just going to skip through the next, do you have any ideas in your head about, like, the kind of character that would really lean into this? Or something that DMs should, like, keep in mind when they're running a plot hook or an adventure when it comes to reputation or renown? Is there anything that stands out to you, Casey?
Well, yeah, okay, my mind went back to when we were playing L5R and your character, Adam, which, like, had to be a bard. That's just what they would have been. They would have just been, like, a political figure bard versus a performer, like, on stage bard. So, I mean, that one just fits the easiest. To take the easiest route since I'm first.
I see bards really, like, with the entertainment factor as well. You could have this with, if there was like a series of theaters or bars that were like a chain or whatnot. Honestly, assassins guilds with rogues, this makes sense. Fighters in a military structure, right? Barbarians within their own tribe. Like, there tends to be an organization for each one. Like, clerics and paladins clearly have organizations behind them.
Yeah.
But it's going to be harder for things like rangers and sorcerers. It doesn't seem as obvious. Even warlocks feel like they're doing their shit in the altar in the closet. They're not holding cult meetings. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Kyle, any thoughts?
Well, I mean,
I know that look on your face. I said stuff and you went, Let me double check. I got to fact check what he just fucking said. So,
no, more I was like, well, did he not say anything? Because I was going to say clerics. That seems like the most obvious to me, right? They are trying to rank up. They go from, you know, altar boy to clergyman to, you know, bishop, whatever. That's probably the biggest one to me. Other than that, yeah, rangers is going to be tough. Druids, you could even do it too. How well they're looked upon within their circles.
I even feel like wizards, you would have like three levels. There'd be like scribe, researcher, and then like archmage that is invited to the wizard circle, right? Like,
yeah,
totally.
It's to come to the cool orgy rituals.
Hey, that's the dream in every Dungeons and Dragons campaign.
Yeah.
All right, that's all that I've got on Renown then. Let's move on to the next bit. Who's got who's DM3? Who do we have?
It's me. We're moving on to carousing.
Carousing? Carousing?
Carousing?
Yeah.
Oh, I liked carousing better.
It's a carousel. It's carousing.
I'm pretty sure that's what John Travolta does in Grease.
Carousing?
Yeah. K-5, carousing. Also known as drinking excessively and disturbing the peace with the joy of others.
This is what you do on Friday nights. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something we can all relate to. And essentially, it's what we mostly default to in D&D downtime. It's like, what do you want to do? I want to go to the tavern and drink at the bar. And then, you know. So if you are also trying to carouse with different levels of class, it's going to cost you. So this is where there's a mechanic to who you are carousing with. And the cost is based on a work week, which we have mentioned in the other episodes as well, which is a 5-day, 10-day work week. All right. So carousing with the lower class is going to cost you 10 gold pieces. So think criminals, mercenaries, town guard. You're paying them off for like gaining some information, or you're, you know, doing some side deals with them. Middle class is up to 50 gold pieces. So this is going to be guild members, town officials, and spellcasters. And then you move into your upper class, and that is where it's going to cost you up to 250 gold pieces for the work week. So this is also going to require you having actual access to that upper class. So think nobles or their servants, where you're going to need to first gain invitation to a formal party, or perhaps sneak your way into a formal banquet that they're attending using a disguise kit to pass as nobles. And all of that is definitely going to cost more money, hence the 250 gold pieces. Because also they're not going to be drinking the, you know, tavern dishwater. They're going to want like fancy food. You're going to be paying out of your nose for food and drink to socialize with this class. So it can definitely get like there's a lot more math and a lot more tracking as you're trying to do this. But if a character has noble background, this is going to be easier, obviously, and they may also have more funds to do that more easily. It will be up to the DM's discretion on whether other characters are successful that don't have the noble background. So the DMG has a charisma or persuasion check table to determine how successful a character is at carousing. So, for example, a 1 to 5, the character has made hostile contact. Really unsuccessful. You did not get what you wanted. You now have potentially made an enemy. But if you roll 16 to 20, the character has been successful and has actually made 2 allied contacts. So it scales up and you can gain quite a bit. 21 plus is 3 allied contacts. So allied contact. They essentially become bonded NPCs and each owe the character a favor, or if it goes very poorly, has a grudge. And so that depends on this check table. Once a contact has helped the character or hindered the character, More carousing will be necessary to use the NPC as an allied contact again. So it's basically they owe you a favor. You use that favor at some point, and like you got to start over to get them to have another favor for you. And so depending on your campaign and your DM, you can assign NPCs as key contacts before the party encounters them and just have them shortlisted. Or you can let it happen more organically and then assign them on the spot. And like after there's a moment of carousing happening in downtime. The character may then keep them on the shortlist along the campaign. So think like this is where I imagine the like, okay, look, I know a guy scenario where you're looking for something specific and you have them on a shortlist. It's like, oh, I know a guy for this. But it all has to make sense. Like you can't call forth an allied contact NPC that is from another realm or another city across the map that relates to what you're trying to do. Like it, like you have to be able to actually contact them and use them realistically. So keep that in mind. And it also needs to make sense from a social class as well. Like it's just, you can't interact like criminals with nobles and then expect that to go well. Like it's just, yeah, it has to be realistic. And there's also a mechanic on how many allied contacts you can have. And I feel like Dan would need this because he would just be like, give me all of them as soon as he knows this is an option. So the max is equal to 1 plus the character's charisma modifier. And there's a minimum of 1. And this refers to the ones that owe a favor or are hostile. So if you use the favor, that person comes off the list of the max that you have. So you can keep like adding and minusing from there. And just like in real life, there are always complications with these sort of allied contacts. There is a 10% chance of complications arising for every work week of carousing. There could be bar brawls, tarnished reputations, and the DMG has a D8 table to roll complications based on the class. So it's quite interesting and hilarious. I'm just going to quickly roll one and give an example. Okay, so for lower class carousing complications, there is the complication is streaking naked through the streets seemed like a great idea at the time. So that's lower class complication.
How dare you call me lower class?
Yeah, this is totally
I'll have accurate. You know, streaking is still a great idea.
And then comparatively for middle class, there is you made a drunken toast that scandalized the locals. And then if we're going to upper class, you have become the target of a variety of embarrassing rumors. And so this can also involve like a rival, not necessarily just a disgruntled allied contact. So, you know, you can easily come up with things on your own, but the table kind of gives you some fun things of how things go wrong. And it all depends on how the player rolls. If they roll poorly, then it gets more fun. So Xanathar's also does not fuck around with some of the updates they have for this. I just like had to laugh because it blatantly calls out carousing as hedonistic activities, including partying, binge drinking, gambling, and or anything else that helps them cope with the perils they face on their adventures. I'm like, wow.
Jesus.
Tell us how you really feel. And so in Xanathar's, money spent equates to a wealthy lifestyle. So can't we all relate? Just like trying to keep up. It's like, let's worry about this in the morning. Just hand over the credit card. So players must roll a percentile dice, adding the player's character level to that. And that determines what happens at the end of carousing. So there is a full table for this. And so you basically give it your best shot at carousing at a wealthy lifestyle that's going to cost you. And then you see whether you are successful or not based on that. So it's a little bit more, I feel like if this is your first as a DM, if this is your first go at carousing and trying to track that, this would be a more like straightforward way to deal with it versus dealing with lower, middle, and upper class and all of that. It can just be like, okay, we're in a tavern. There's 30 or 40 like patrons in here. It's a shit show. What do you want to do? And we're just going to see what the hell happens. Yeah, and that is carousing.
That actually sounds like a fuck ton of fun. This is totally for your murder hobo party though. So
yeah.
let's keep the same initiative order for now. So Casey, you're first. I'm gonna say right now, besides rogue and bard, do you have a class? Is there a race or background or a character archetype or something that really stands out to you as being like thematically tied to this?
Well, okay, so my brain went to like thinking Lord of the Rings tavern, like Strider sitting in the bar and then, you know, people wanting to go up to him and like talk shit and figure things out and, you know, things pop off. I feel like a fighter could be a low key, not wanting to carouse, but ultimately will get involved in the bar fight and overhear something at the next table that really pisses them off, or they really want to get that information. They're like, what did you just say? And use some intimidation. So I kind of like a fighter in this scenario, if we're talking about bar fights.
My initial thought during all of this was, this is what your halfling is doing. This is halfling nonsense. So in between quests, when they've got some downtime, they're going to be in the bar socializing. And there are some things that I think don't promote this very well, like tieflings of high charisma, but they're social outcasts in most campaigns. So probably not them at first, at least. But there will definitely be some that lean into this. Some of the different playable races, like I expect firbolgs are pretty sociable too, if you can actually start chatting them up. And Goliaths are going to want to get into arm wrestling competitions, and like there's going to be enough stuff. And I think Ranger fits nicely in this too, because when they do come into town, they might be looking for a specific thing or trying to get information. And so I like the fact that this is fucking about with purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right.
Kyle, what do you think?
I mean, my first thought was Drunken Master Monk. Seems like the obvious choice. You know, I kind of like it. I think it's interesting. I would probably throttle the, like, what your acquaintances are going to do, these new contacts you made, because I mean, it's a drinking buddy you met in a bar once. Like, how far are you really going to go for that person? Right. Like, they might have some tangential evidence or like clues or something, or, you know,
I was just thinking though, unless what you're doing is you're targeting people to go focus on, like, I'm going to take this guy out for expensive sushi and strippers, and then this guy's going to, like, I'm going to be on his good side now. Right. So if it's that kind of thing, then I like these rules a lot. If it's, it can go either way, right? Like, you can be targeting specific people and being that con man that Kyle wants to be, or you can just be the drunken fool like Dan wants to be. So
yeah, and like, okay. I imagine you can cause the bar fight, but then it's the bar fight where who you're fighting in the very end, you end up sharing a final beer with, and you leave the tavern like on good terms. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the next time you're in town and you walk in, you see them sitting at the bar and it's like, huh? And like, that's how you kind of build that like allied relationship with them. It's like, oh yeah, we beat each other up last time. Like, what'd you learn? Like, what's new? And you kind of get. Yeah.
All right. Oh, I also like this for if you are using renown, right? Like, this is a good way for to get the townspeople to know who you are. You go into a bar, you have a great time, you are the life of the party. All of a sudden, everybody in the town starts looking at you a little bit better.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah. Do we have a quick plot hook or call to adventure, something you could tie into this downtime activity?
You get poisoned while you're drinking, and now you have to figure out who's poisoning the booze in the town.
Yeah, honestly, there, all of those complications on those tables are plot hooks, right? Like, there's goodness in all of them. I don't know. Like, my big thing is, There's not a whole lot for the mastermind rogue to be doing, or the College of Eloquence bard to be doing, like, in downtime. This is, I think, what they are, like, uniquely skilled and geared towards doing. So I'm going to tie it into whatever they're... You know, when you're doing your session zero and people are like writing their stories and you ask for a backstory, and you've got the people that are like, I'm a barbarian, my backstory is fight. And then you've got the mastermind rogue or the College of Eloquence bard, who is going to give you three fucking pages because that's who chooses these kind of subclasses, right? I'm going to be mining their backstory for specifically this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. And that's where, like, you even do it, Adam, where you want us to kind of outline, like, what are some potential key characters that might play a role from your past that will come up in the future? So those could be easily those, like, shortlisted people. Yeah.
Yeah. I always like starting off with contacts, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we can gain more. I do like that there's a fucking cap on it, though, because, my God, you know, I don't even need to say the player's name. You know who would just abuse the shit out of that.
I do like the mechanic of, oh, I know a guy that you can use. Like, these contacts don't have to be names or faces. It's just like, oh, I'm looking to buy a particular item. Oh, I know a guy who might be able to sell it. Like, especially if you're going into the buying and selling magical items.
Was it you and I that discussed that in a previous episode a long time ago, Kyle? The I know a guy mechanic?
Yeah, I saw a tweet or something about it online and I posted it, and it's like, allows your players to have like, oh, I know a guy mechanic, right? Where they can just make up on the spot and then they give like a quick backstory about how they might know this person.
Yeah, it encourages improv. Again, it's soft, right? Like, there's no hard mechanic. Maybe everybody can do this once per tier or once per level, whatever works for your table, right? But like, they're not going to be able to pull your ass out of a fire if you're trapped by a beholder in a dungeon, right? However, when you're in town and you need to whatever, like, advance the plot, and you guys are stumped, like, I think it's a great idea of, instead of handing out inspiration, I know a guy, right?
I like that.
Yeah. So let's move on to the next one, which, speaking of carousing, I think you actually said the word gambling in yours, Casey. So let's talk about it, because gambling actually has rules now.
It does. So from Xanathar's, to gamble, it's going to cost your player a week of their time, and they get to choose a dollar amount anywhere between 10 and 1,000 gold. So this is basically what they are betting on during the week. You have them roll three times for insight, deception, intimidation, and they can replace any of those rolls with their proficiency in a relevant gaming set. So if they're proficient with dice, they can use that tool proficiency instead of one of the three skills. You as a DM are also going to roll three different DCs that are going to equal 2d10 plus 5. And this is to kind of reflect the competition that they are going to face during the week, right? The randomization of how strong a player sitting across the table from you is going to be. Out of these three rolls, if they get zero successes, they lose all the money and accrue debt equal to their starting capital. So if they bet 1,000 gold, they lost all that 1,000, and now they also owe 1,000 on top of that. If they get one success, they only lose 50% of their money. Two successes, they get to keep all their money and gain 50% on top of that. Or three successes, they double whatever money they bet on going into it. Xanathar's also gives you silver complications. Picking two at random, you are accused of cheating, and you decide whether you actually did cheat or were framed. This might involve a rival. Or two, the town guards raid the gambling hall and throw you in jail. And now the party or you have to figure out how you're going to get out.
I love this. This is actually a lot of fun, especially because I think it's Keys from the Golden Vault has a heist where you're robbing a gambling establishment. So like casing the place out for a couple of weeks ahead of time, and everybody has to gamble, right? Because you're hanging out there. So here we go, doing the Ocean's 11 shit. So let's reroll initiative.
Big old three.
Oh, 19.
Casey, you're using your high roll for the day. You got to stop it. It's no good.
Damn it. Screwed.
All right. Well, we're in the same initiative order. So Casey, How do you feel about gambling? Is there something, class, race, background, archetype, anything that makes you think, hey, this is good for this kind of character?
Hey, well, for whatever reason, there always seems to be, especially in maybe a larger party, somebody who in the past had a gambling addiction, or like you got to have some sort of like past addiction trauma. I don't know. It's like used to be an alcoholic, used to be a gambler. I don't know.
Every single campaign, there's one.
Yes. And there is always somebody, even if they're brand new to D&D, like read up about like having, when they're picking proficiency or picking things, like the arcane trickster, of course, comes to mind, where it's like, ooh, this is fun. I'm going to maybe gamble along the way. And then it never happens. So this is the opportunity for the DM to go, oh, there is actually this mechanic. So even if everybody's sitting around the fire, like during the first watch of like an overnight camp or something, you could just play this in like a lower level between two players. The one that always wants to play, wants to gamble because they have the dice set or whatever. So I really like it because you can scale up the risk and scale up the cost. And yeah, some players will really love that. And I mean, you could even have a massive sidebar if somebody bets big and loses big. And now they like need to go borrow money from some shady person. And now they owe a guy versus they know a guy. So rogues, arcane trickster, where I went.
The thing that occurred to me as you were talking, and I probably should have thrown this into the breakdown before we got started, is there's a subclass called, or there's a background called gambler in Acquisitions Incorporated. So like you can straight up build your character to be a gambler, straight with like personality traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws, right? Just to give you the quick bit, you get proficiency in deception and insight. Were those two of the options for that role, Kyle? There was insight, deception, and intimidation, right?
Yeah.
So you would be proficient in at least two of them. You get proficiency in one gaming set. You get any one language of your choice. But then you get a feature called Never Tell Me the Odds. Odds and probability, I'm just going to read it verbatim. Odds and probability are your bread and butter. During downtime activities that involve games of chance, so specifically this, or figuring odds on the best plan, you can get a solid sense of which choice is likely the best one and which opportunities seem too good to be true at the DM's determination. So you can just turn to the DM and be like, seriously, what's the right answer? Or is this a bad idea?
Amazing.
The answer is always no.
So, yeah, for me, I'm like, I don't even need to come up with an archetype for this. It is clearly just be a gambler. So, also, are we a little offended by the fact that, like, it's implied that gambling is illegal in D&D?
What do you mean?
Well, the town guards were raiding the establishment and threw you in jail simply for gambling. Like, if I'm in a casino, isn't it, like, legal?
Yeah, I think they're thinking of, like, underground games, you know, where people are not paying taxes on their winnings.
Yeah. I also like, I would tie most casinos to some sort of organized crime as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Kyle, any thoughts about class, race, background, archetype?
Okay, yeah. I purely because I was trying to think of, like, how could I fuck with this the most? I think the most fun or the most scared I would be as a DM is if someone was either a trickery domain cleric or a divination or illusion wizard. Because I mean, like, how do you increase your chances gambling the most?
With like
if I can make that die say whatever I want it to say.
Well, like the lucky feat and the like you're just consistently throwing rerolls at people and shit. Like, yeah.
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 Yeah. These are the dice. These are the numbers you're looking for. Oh, you got them. Congratulations.
I love the idea that you've got like a bard sitting across the table from you with silvery barbs. It's just like, no, reroll. Right. And like, this is the version of counting cards. It's like the magical version of that. So,
yeah. I can imagine like this goes a deep dive, and then your 8 hour long rest turns into like 4 hours of gameplay because suddenly every player wants to gamble and every player wants to do this and use their skills that they have to try and use it in this way. And it would be hilarious and exhausting. And non-productive in the long run. The DM would be like, we were supposed to go, you know, do all this other stuff. And now we're just gambling for 4 hours. All right.
Yeah.
So definitely don't tell Dan about this episode.
Do you have a plot hook or anything revolving around gambling, Casey?
Well, like I mentioned, I guess, I kind of like the idea of like when it goes fucking wrong and suddenly you either you are gambling to try and get the money back to pay off the bad dude, and then it goes even worse. And so you're in big trouble and there's someone after you, their bouncers are after you, you know, that kind of plot hook where suddenly there's this sidebar where you're now, until you leave this city, you are like running, you're looking over your shoulder the entire time, you know?
Yeah.
Poor rolls can really fuck you up in this one.
My big concern, I don't really have a plot hook necessarily around this. Like there's millions of plot hooks I could put around gambling, but like my concern is that my players are going to love this and want to do it so much. And I know that Charlie has been the gambling addict in the past and Dan has played a gambling addict in the past and whatnot. We're doing Secret Santa later today, which just goes to show you like how early we record these episodes. It's going to come out in like March or something, but like we're doing Secret Santa and I got Dave. And so I actually went and got him 3 Dragon Ante, which is the official product from Wizards of the Coast about like actual gambling. It's a fucking card game. 70 different dragon cards and 15 mortal cards. And like, they're cardboard gold pieces and platinum pieces. And like, there's a whole fucking rule book about this. And the idea is this is an in-world gambling game. And they actually made this together. It says a rogue, a paladin, and a warlock walk into a tavern to gather information and blah, 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 blah. They have to kick back with a game of 3 Dragon Ante. So I'm totally like excited for Dave to say, yeah, well, we're going to do this. Yeah. So exactly. I low-key kind of want to play it independent of D&D as well, just to like play the game. Maybe if enough people cancel, we'll just be like, Dave, bring over 3 Dragon Ante and we'll all sit around and get drunk and play this game. So
yeah.
Kyle, any plot hooks or ideas?
Yeah, you know, the opposite of Cassie's idea, rather than losing a whole bunch, you win too much. And now your name is kind of known throughout the land, you know, casino, like down in Vegas, if you get banned from one casino, they'll circulate your picture and let other casinos know as well. So I kind of imagine that. So you might have a couple of years where you go into a new town, you want to go gambling and, oh, they know who you are. Oh, you got to put on disguise kit, or, you know, they find out you are a divination wizard or an illusion wizard. And they're like, well, this guy is clearly cheating.
Or you win big and you have to, you got to watch out for being basically like burgled, like jumped when you leave.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one, too. Okay. So, you know what? The one thing I do like about this mechanic, because I do, you know, we were talking about a lot how it's open to abuse, is that it does take a work week to gamble once, right? So, your players aren't going to be able to do it every single day, every time they have a rest, right? It is. You know, for the next 8 sessions, you gamble once or something like that.
It's worth pointing out that a lot of this stuff is based on zooming out and having long downtime, right? Which makes me feel like it's the gritty realism resting rules where it takes one 8 hour one 8 hour section or chunk of downtime to get a short rest and a week to get a long rest, right? Mm. And so that's when this stuff would come into play. Do you guys, like, before we move on, do you guys like how long this shit takes? Or would you rather it be on a, like, night-by-night basis?
I like how long it takes.
Yeah. I honestly do, too. It keeps the fuck around to find out from getting unmanageable.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if I... because I'm currently playing a campaign where we're in one city for a long time, what I'd probably do is, you know, have a bunch of sessions that's going to take about a week and then be like, okay, so after this week... how do you guys want to have spent your downtime during this, right? Like, you're back in town. I'll give you one thing that you can do that you've been doing for like 2 hours every day.
Yeah, I think it depends. It depends on your player's style. Like, some people will just not engage in that at all. So you can't force it and be like, no, suck it up. Like, oh, you're going to do absolutely nothing for this month we're in this town. Okay, sure. So maybe like, I like having that option for, you know, it taking a work week, but I think you're gonna, at some point you're gonna have to tailor it to be like in your downtime while you're on the road. And maybe you're on the road for 10 days. And so every evening around the campfire, this downtime stuff happens. So you still achieve that, but you're still keeping the story or keeping the party moving, which some players really like.
Yeah. Let's move on to the next kind of seedy downtime activity.
I don't understand what's seedy about pit fighting. Okay. You know, it's just you and your bows hanging out, knocking the snot out of somebody.
His name was Robert Paulson. His name was Robert Paulson. That is an old joke that not many people will get. All right, continue, Kyle.
So pit fighting can include a number of different things. It can either be boxing, wrestling, it says other non-lethal forms of combat, but I'm guessing arm wrestling doesn't come into this.
No, those
Russian slap contests.
Oh, there you go. Have you seen those? I was trying to think, what else is like a non-lethal combat? I guess like mixed martial arts. Megan's character went through a bunch of martial arts, underground martial arts tournaments, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This would fit into this. So resources, it doesn't require anything. It doesn't cost you anything. It's just time. It's going to take you a week like the rest of them. You are going to roll 3 times for athletics, acrobatics, and a special con save that takes the player's largest health die and adds it to the roll as your bonus. One of those rolls can also be replaced by a weapon attack, so whatever your weakest roll is. Once again, you're setting 3 DCs by rolling 2d10 plus 5. This time with 0 successes, you win no monies. 1 success, you win 50 gold. 2 successes, 100 gold. And 3 successes, 200 gold. So, you know, there's a lot less risk involved than there is with gambling, which I find a little weird, you know. There's obviously still complications, but nothing really stands out, right? Like, if you lose gambling, you can lose twice your money and have to get a debt. With this one, it feels like you should, like, 0 successes, you should, like, break a bone or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
Just to keep it with the idea of there being penalty, I feel like for every one of the times that you fail throughout the week, you would get dropped down to a, you know, certain percentage of hit points, and you cannot regain hit dice on a long rest, right? Like, it wipes you the fuck out for 24 hours. You're not pit fighting day after day after day. Just to make the players go, well, wait a minute, what if something pops off later, right? Like, what if we get interrupted this week? I like that's really punishing. I'm not sure I would do that, but maybe like you can't use hit dice to heal on a short rest because you've just been beaten the fuck up. All your hit dice have been spent, but you can still regain half of them on your next long rest, right?
All right. Something or like, you have a level of exhaustion for a week.
Yeah, or even for a day, because like during all of this downtime that people are doing, I am still going to throw thugs and assassins and enemy guild members at parties or every once in a while, right? So there will be combat that pops off. Just because you're in town doesn't mean you're safe, right?
Yeah.
And so maybe I won't do it the first time or two, but like the third time, I need there to be something to make it so that not every one of my players, including the fucking wizard, goes at this, because there's no downside. The wizard would get into pit fighting.
Yeah.
Well, and you can bring in the reputation, renown, and ranks thing to this too, because maybe this is your barbarian's way of making money because they need money for some reason. And so there's levels to the pit fighting. You come in at the bottom level where you're in the sewers and you're fighting amongst the rats, and you got to work your way up to the actual like arena style pit fighting where you actually can make good money. Can make it pretty complicated that way to build it up.
Oh, you know, another thing that you could do too is Because every D&D party, at most tables that I've been at, eventually in some campaign, you guys end up in a gladiatorial pit.
Yeah, right? That's so, totally what I was thinking.
Yeah. But
every game without fail.
But I would absolutely use this and just change what the results are. So you're still using the entire mechanics, except it's not about winning money. It's about gaining renown or pleasing the crowd or earning your freedom or something. Right. So,
yeah.
So turn this into a multiple week long. How long does it take you to become a champion? And there are ranks, and maybe one success gets you one rank, and two gets you two, and three gets you three. But you got to get up to 50 to, like, how many weeks do you spend in here while the world outside moves on? Right. Shit like that. Like, I really like this mechanic, actually, of the roll three times.
Mm-hmm. And
you know what? I'm kind of inspired by these. Casey, do you have any class, race, background, or character archetype besides a barbarian?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to steal, I guess, Kaya here, Megan's character for the monk, because that's also a perfect scenario. Like, visually, you know, this little half elf monk going that's under 5 feet going after a 6 foot tall minotaur barbarian in a weapon free combat, you know, in a pit fight. So kind of stacking, like, visually stacking the odds very disproportionate would be entertaining.
Man, I wish we had the rights to the Mortal Kombat theme.
Mortal Kombat. Can I even say that?
Are we able to test our might? Is that okay? Yeah. The archetype, the thing that I'm looking at mostly is this is just built into Goliaths, mm-hmm. right? That this is what their jam is. Like, hey, we've done hiking up the fucking mountain for the day. Everybody's eating. What do you want to do? I don't know. Punch each other? Yeah, I'm in. Right? I think that you would get probably not bugbears to get in on this because they're lazy as all fuck, but I bet orcs would jump on this in a heartbeat as well. You're going to find orcs, and like, if it's like an arena styling, the last one's a fucking Etten or something, right? Like, it just gets bigger and beefier and more nasty. Maybe the second last one is an Etten, and the last one is a very calm, very still gnome, and it's just fucking terrifying.
Yeah,
I like that. Okay, I have two. One of them is like left field, and it's just because Casey mentioned in a sewer fighting rats, and that would be a turtle.
God damn it,
Kai. Come on.
God damn it. Yes, it would.
Yeah. Oh my God, yes.
And then the other one is not so much a background or a class or anything, but this would be perfect for your player who took Tavern Brawler.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Or a grappler or any one of those feats that kind of fit into this. Definitely Tavern Brawler, though.
I would absolutely give advantage on one of those roles if someone's like spent their limited resources and leveling on being good at specifically this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any like additional plot hooks or adventures besides Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or anything else?
Always gonna be great.
I mean, I didn't bring it up earlier, but the D6 complications that they have are actually like pretty fun, right? You know, an opponent swears to take revenge on you, or you defeat a local champion, drawing the crowd's ire, right? Like, it opens up a lot of possibilities that could be really fun. So, you know, I would definitely recommend checking out the complications table.
I love the idea that you finally beat like the big scary dragonborn and the crowd fucking turns on you, and you don't find out until later that his brother just died the day before and he's in mourning, and you should have just thrown the fight for him, right? Like, insult to injury, and now the town chases you out. Like,
yeah.
Ooh, that just like, what if you go in to do this and then your ally contact calls in the favor to you, you owe them a favor, and they want you to throw the fight.
Oh,
they're like, you must lose.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I think that's so much fun. I think like that would just annoy the shit out of most players.
Yeah. Like, I'm thinking. Yeah, like Dave would be like, really? Because could he do it or could he not? And then that causes a whole other level of fuckery.
I would make them roll two times and then choose whether or not they want to fail the third one. Like, let them see how, like, because if they win two in a row, then they've got to, like, maybe do a performance check to fucking dive at the last bit, right?
Yeah, okay, I like that. I think it also could make interesting inter-party politics, right? Like, you have that one pit fighter who's, let's say, the cocky, like, constantly, like, I am the greatest, I'm the strongest. And then the contact is actually a contact of another party member. So the party member has to come and be like, listen, I need this from you. Please, can you do this for me?
Yeah.
Make them fight a romantic interest.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Make Dan enter the ring and have to fight Megan's romantic interest in the fucking pit fight.
Amazing.
What else do we have as far as seedy bullshit that we can do in our downtime?
Well, we got sowing rumors. I think we kind of alluded to this at the very beginning too, about it's tied to reputation and all of that. It's touched on relatively briefly in the DMG. But it does outline how a character can use rumors to bring down a villain or help a friend or ally and accomplish a goal. The rumors can be simple or complex, and depending on how successful you are, it can turn the tables in a campaign. Like, if you really need this to stick in order to move on to the next phase and you are shit at it, like, it could make you re-strategize how to move forward. So sowing a rumor requires days, which must be continuous in most cases. And there is a table to determine how many days based on the size of community. So, for example, a village will take 2d6 days to start sow a rumor, but a city will take 6d6 days to sow a rumor. So depending on your angle and objective, you like the time will extend, and it will also cost money. So it's 3 gold pieces per day, and the character must make a DC 15 charisma save for the rumor to take. Rumors don't necessarily impact everyone in the community either, but a successful one will impact those involved with the desired outcome of the rumor. So yeah, like your villagers that are just the farmers on the outskirts of the big city probably won't get involved in knowing the rumor, but the parties that need to know the rumor and be impacted by the rumor will. And that's essentially it. It's pretty straightforward. It's just this and this if you want to tackle it.
Sorry, I double checked it because you said a charisma save. It says a deception or persuasion check that uses charisma. I just thought that save was a little odd.
Where did I get charisma save?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I just wrote DC 15 charisma.
Yeah.
And went with that. Okay, my apologies. Yes. So it requires a DC 15 charisma check, which is deception or persuasion. Yeah.
Oh, you know what'd be kind of funny though is if you do make them do a charisma save, to not fall for other rumors that they hear while trying to spread a rumor.
I like that. I mean, that's what your insight is for, right?
Yeah, that's true.
How do we feel about this? Do we like this sowing rumors? Like, look, I'm gonna ask, how often do you think this is gonna come up in a campaign?
Depends on the campaign. Doing a high political one.
Yeah. This is very L5RE as well, I feel like.
Yeah, I was gonna say this could also be like a Call of Cthulhu thing to like seed the rumors about undermining a cult that's growing or something, right? So you could find mechanics for this. The idea of it taking 6d6 uninterrupted days to sow a rumor in a city is fucking intense.
Yeah.
Who's got potentially 36 days to sit around? Instead of asking who's going to do this, because I think really anybody could, by the time that you come up with the idea of sowing rumors around, it's not just the bard. Like, this seems like a quest. Like, everyone in the party is going to do it. Would you have it so that you take, like, let's say you have a party of 4 and they roll 4 that's in a town, they roll 4d6 and they end up with like 16 days they've got to do it. Would you divide it by 4 so they only have to go out for 4 days, each person has to go out and do it so that you're spreading the rumor more in a shorter period of time? Or would you keep it at just being the four, like the 16 days or whatever?
No, I like the idea of multiple people working on it together, right? Kind of like the crafting rules where you can get a bunch of people together and do it. So, you know, you go take the northwest corner, I'll go take the southeast corner, blah, blah, blah.
The two of us will work together and that'll give us advantage on the roll, like that kind of shit, right? Like, oh my God, you heard that too in a bar. So
I think that's very reasonable.
Yeah. You know what else I like? I like combining it with other downtown activities. Like you can combine this with the carousing, right? Like you go out, you carouse, you made three allied contacts. Now you can use those contacts to go continue spreading this rumor, cutting down the time even further.
I really like that.
Or someone's out pit fighting and they're talking about rumors as well to the other people that are there,
like talking them up.
Or just like, you know, between your bouts, you're hanging out with the other fighters and you kind of casually drop this into conversation, and then, you know, that'll give you a bonus or drop a die for how long it's going to take.
In the last episode we talked about building like your work and whatnot as well, and starting a business. And this could be like, it doesn't have to be negative rumors. You can have people just go and be like, hey, did you hear about the new shop on Main Street? Right. And just get the word out there, like guerrilla marketing almost.
Yeah.
And you could use it also for like gaining access to people that aren't accessible, whether they are like upper class or like upper class criminals. What came to mind is we are potentially going to try and ally or at least talk to some very high powered vampires in our campaign. I don't know, one of our party members just desperately wants to do that while no one else does. But like, I can see how you could start a rumor mill in the city that they are like primarily based out of and either do it like, facetiously or like you're obsessed with them and try and like cause a rumor that results in them having to seek you out and be like, okay, this fucking dude, like, I need to like set up a meeting. We need to talk to them because of the rumors that you're spreading. You might be like sabotaging their underground organization and by causing these rumors. And so you're trying to like gain access to the big guy behind the closed doors.
This also might be useful for if you're dealing with cults that are growing or an evil organization that is slowly starting to gain momentum in a city. This is how you hold that shit at bay. So like you force your players to like, here's the DM, we're going to do this and this and this, but then you need to spend some time undermining them. And maybe these sowing rumors include propaganda posters or whatever. Like, you tell me what you want to do. Who do you want to talk to? Go down to the docks and talk to the people. Like, a lot of these evil organizations, they deal with a lot of the poor people, a lot of the working class people. That's how they get in. Right. And so go down and befriend and undermine that with the lower class. Right. And so now you have your noble paladin and your kind of fancy bard putting on like dock workers' clothes and going into a bar to do this in their evenings. Right. So I think there's a lot of neat stuff to do with this. I feel like one gold piece per day is a little cheap.
It's 3 gold pieces per day. No, it's where am I? What am I out to lunch on with this? I feel like, man, yeah, I was wrong on that too. I like 3 gold pieces.
it should be expensive. I don't like when people tell rumors about me, so fuck you guys. So no, I think that it should be that gold piece. I like it. It should scale. 1 gold piece in poor neighborhoods or working class, and then for like your middle class, again, I'd break it up. Now it's 5 gold pieces, and then upper class would be like 15, right? So you got to convince the nobility, which means you got to buy the clothes. Now we're looking at the carousing rules again, right? So
totally.
Yeah. I also think of it as like I would do it by settlement size, right? Like the village, you know, there's only 100 people there, whereas your town, you've got 1,000, and then the city, you've got upwards of 25,000, right? So you're spending, I don't know, let's say 1, 5, and 10 per day. Mm-hmm. You're there.
I think I also Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I really like this if you are playing something like a Harper's campaign, right? Where you are the bard in... I'm just thinking of, you know, the movie, right? Where Chris Pine is the bard sitting in a bar all day, right? That's the perfect time for you to drop rumors about stuff that's going on or people that you should avoid or, you know... if you have a vampire campaign, you know, you got someone going in gambling and they're like, oh, how are you winning so much? Well, you know, I just keep my lucky clove of garlic on me at all times. So also, okay, is it Megan that wants to meet the vampires?
No, it's Charlie.
It's not. Oh. It's Charlie.
Wow. All right.
If I remember correctly, it was Megan and Dan who floated the idea originally and then decided it was dumb, but then Charlie landed on it and said, we're doing this. And has just, through sheer force of will, talked everyone else into this. And Casey, who's supposed to be the leader of the group, is sitting back going, man, I don't care. I'll kill some vampires. Fuck, let's go. Like, yeah. I'm like, you guys are level 6. Please don't fucking die.
Yeah. I'm like, if it will get this conversation to end, fine.
That actually summarizes a lot of how you vote as the leader of the group. And I am very aware of that. So,
democracy at work.
So we've talked about gaining levels. We've talked about crafting. We've talked about running your own business and rising in ranks and being a part of guilds. We've talked about gambling and fighting and sowing rumors. But we started this episode based on the idea of crime. Kyle, you are allegedly one of the three most criminal people on this episode. So let's take it away. Tell us a little bit about crime.
Crime. So, I mean, it says crime, which is pretty varied, but it's pretty much specifically talking about robbing people. So to do a crime, it's going to cost you 1 week of time and 25 gold for the information. So dropping bribes, you know, being in the right places, getting guards to look the other way while you scout out shops and stuff. The DC is chosen by the player that go in increments of 5. So, you know, we start at 10 for an easy one, 15, 20, and 25. And the rewards are commensurate based on the whatever DC they choose. For DC 10, they are basically robbing a struggling merchant. The potential payout is a maximum of 50 gold, all the way up to robbing nobles, or like the richest people in town, or essentially the richest person in town, that can give you a payout of up to 1,000 gold pieces. And this DC is 25 for robbing one of the richest figures in town. So you're rolling 3 times stealth, you're rolling dex plus your thieves tool proficiency, and their choice of investigation, perception, or deception. If the players have no successes, they are caught and jailed. For 1 success, they get away, but they also get nothing. 2 successes nets them 50% of the payout, and 3 successes gains them the full payout. It also gives you a D8 table of complications for this one, including an unknown person contacts you, threatening to reveal your crime if you don't render a service, or the victim asks one of your adventuring companions to solve the actual crime that you committed, which would be really fun.
Is that everything?
That's it. It's really short.
Where did which book did you find that in?
Xanathar's. Is there also one in?
No. I was just curious because I wrote down on the breakdown DMG and I was looking at it and I'm like, no, it isn't.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this? Is this comprehensive enough?
Yeah, I mean, I would like a little more variety in what kind of crime you can commit, right? You know, I wouldn't mind cattle rustling would be pretty fun.
Jesus Christ, Kyle. I was thinking in previous editions, this would have been a splat book. They would have given you a 120-page soft cover book devoted entirely to doing crimes. Here are all the mechanics, right? Or that would have been a book with 4 or 5 like class options, or you know, 8 pages on feats about crime. And then there would have been all of these different mechanics for the different kinds of crime. And do you want to be a con artist? Do you want to be a thug? Do you want to be a thief? Do you want to be a murderer? Like they would have gone through it. This is so simplified, and I feel like it is good enough for thieves, which we literally have a subclass called thief, so good enough. Yeah. But we also have a party full of murderers, So I'm just like, I'm wondering why they didn't give us more. This could have been a big section. I'm with you on this.
It could have been, but I also like that they didn't make it too big, because I would worry that if it's too much or it's too appetizing and appealing to players, it's going to derail your entire campaign.
That's true. And frankly, you can adapt pit fighting to just be mugging people in an alley with the same roles and the same kind of gold outcome. You can, carousing is another thing that you can do. Like there's ways to do it with the mechanics that we've done on everything else. So I'm surprised at how light it is, considering the reputation of one of the most popular classes in D&D. So,
I mean, isn't Keys of the Golden Vault kind of an extension of this?
Keys from the Golden Vault is 7 different heists that you have to do, but the Golden Vault itself is actually the name of an organization, like a guild, and they're giving you keys like to go do these specific missions, and it's in the name of good. It's not in the name, like, you're stealing, but it's very much for the good guys.
No, like Robin Hood kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you're not giving it to the poor, you're giving it to the Golden Vault. Like there's a purpose behind it, but like, yeah, you can plug and play, right? Like you can pull this stuff out and put it in your own campaign. They're designed to be modular like that. So they absolutely can be for crime. All you need to do is change your motivations, right? So, which is easy enough to do. God knows it's a shifting scale for most players anyway. So do we have any insights about the idea of the class, race, background, character archetype besides the rogue? It was clearly the one this is geared towards. Is there anything, Casey, any insights on that?
Yeah, I'm like all over the place thinking about this, because it's like, well, why? Why would they have this? My brain kind of went to basically, if you're looking at how your which alignment your character is. So this could, I guess, come into play more as a like unexpected thing to use if you have a lawful good player, or even just lawful anything, and they are being told to do a crime and it goes against their like lawful directive, then it might be more substantial to use this. So thinking like, yeah, potentially your paladin or your wizard who is following like a good alignment, like a lawful good alignment, and suddenly they're being asked to use their spells to break in somewhere and steal something, and it just goes against what they're wanting to do. So it can kind of apply to a lot of them, but I kind of went to, it would come into play when you're going against maybe your alignment to do crime.
Honestly, for me, I'm looking at the rules here, and like, there's the 3 roles. The first one is stealth, the second one is thieves tools, and the third one is investigation or perception or deception or whatnot. If you swap out the thieves tools and make it, I don't know, athletics to mug somebody, you could make it sleight of hand to stab someone, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are options here. This will work for all sorts of different crimes. And the only difference is this DC, how difficult things are going to be, and how you have to have levels of how successful the crime is, right? So you might have to make that up on the fly as a DM, but this could apply then to anybody, right? And it's as long as they're like a non-lawful alignment, that is kind of how I'm thinking about this. But even then, sometimes, I mean, law is a personal code of ethics for people too, right? It could very much be a lawful evil character that commits crimes. So
I also feel like people just do this. Like, you're always gonna have to go like break in somewhere or steal something from somebody, and it kind of happens organically. So I guess if you need a tracker and a mechanic to actually do it as a DM, this is it. Like, maybe that's why they put it in. It's like, okay, for somebody who actually needs a tangible way to work through someone getting robbed, there you go.
I've played in enough older editions where people would use their downtime and be like, oh, what are you guys doing? I'm going to work the crowd, see what I can get as far as money, right? Like, and this is, I think, where this comes from. That was a common. The original rogue archetype, when the class was first introduced way back in like original D&D, maybe it was AD&D, when they had like they had a warrior and they had a spellcaster, and then they brought in thief, and that's what it was called. It wasn't called rogue, it was specifically thief, right? And when we look at the rest of the rogue subclasses, it's not just simply I guess you got to get rid of assassin, but every one of the other ones are supposed to be good at stealing. Like it's built right into it, right? So
And I guess they can't have like how to outline how to assassinate someone.
That's the one thing that I want to be like really honest about here is I am so glad because every time that I watch a movie that outlines how to do a crime, I'm sitting there going, you're either giving too much information away and this is sketchy, or you are fucking this up somehow. And I am aware that you are doing this because you can't teach people how to make pipe bombs, even though you're showing your characters making pipe bombs, right? Like we can't teach the audience this. So I'm glad that crime is kind of generalized. It's not going to get into like, what are appropriate methods for stealing from people? How would you like to mug someone in the park one night? Right.
Maybe that's why they did it the way they did it.
Maybe
they had this conversation. Yeah. They're like, whoa, okay.
they're sitting in the writer's room, like, Steve, you're getting real specific and it's problematic. I need you to sit down.
Yeah.
So Kyle, do you have any archetypes for these as well?
Yeah. Okay. So I have a couple ideas. Just because I was looking at like the thieves tools thing. Artificers get thieves tools as like a base proficiency. So, I mean, I like the idea of that. I also like the idea of the artificer not stealing money, but stealing like components, spell components,
mm-hmm.
to go and build their infusions or to make something, right? So they're breaking into an apothecary to get a bunch of things that they normally can't. I was also thinking about an idea of a Robin Hood, right? Like you could play a chaotic good ranger who's going and seeing, you know, a taskmaster who's underpaying his employees. So he goes in the night, robs them, and then redistributes the money to those people.
What's interesting, you said something that made me realize that we don't have to go after money with this, right? Like spell components and stuff. I almost want to have like a mini, like a D6 table for when you hit this DC, this is the kind of shit that you can get. Or maybe I just go to the adventuring gear table, or they've got all sorts of tables in the DMG about different items that are not necessarily magical, like gems or pieces of art or something. Like, what do you find? What do you get? Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so depending on what you roll, that would be not just your level of success, but also what your loot could be besides gold pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Like your party is desperate to find a diamond to revivify someone. And so this is a good way to have a mini game. If you can't figure out like an actual quest point, or you don't want to dedicate a whole bunch of time to it, you can just be like, well, you can go steal it and then use this table to kind of figure out your success.
I also really like the idea of having them, you're after a single item and you've been told only get this one item, leave everything else alone in the museum. And they all go in and they roll high enough that, oh yeah, no, you've defeated all of the security, all of the magical traps and everything. You can get the item, you have it, it's easy. There's a bunch of other stuff you could grab too. Would you like to? You rolled high enough to. And tempt your players like that, because touch nothing but the lamp is so fucking deadly for players. Like they're going, it's like putting a red button in front of them, right?
Yeah,
definitely.
Do we have any other insights before we wrap this up?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. So before we finish off our discussion on downtime activities, let's spend a little time with an info break.
If you've been inspired by the conversation in this episode, please feel free to reach out and share your creativity and ideas with us and the rest of the community. You can reach us on Facebook and Instagram, or on our subreddit, r/itsamimic. Also, if you're feeling particularly generous, please follow and subscribe, and leave us positive reviews, likes, and comments. Engagements like that help us pop up on search engines and keep this show running.
All right, so is there any kind of downtime activity that you think is clearly missing from the list that we've covered so far?
Let's roll initiative.
Oh my God, I am wasting my rolls. 17.
11, bring 13. That die with you to D&D. What'd you get, Kyle?
I got 13.
Okay, so Casey, anything that's clearly sticking out to you?
Like when you combine, because we're going into several different books over this series, like I feel like baseline DMG, heck of a lot. missing, but then they've kind of rectified and built it out, and like they do a good job to cover a lot. So honestly, nothing comes to mind immediately. You just have to have access to several different books and you got it covered.
Kyle?
I would like to see, I don't really know how to work the mechanic, but I would love to see something like community service, you know, like you're doing good or just doing good. Like you're not looking for a tangible benefit, right? So I imagine like clerics and paladins, maybe even monks doing that kind of thing where they're just going out and they're, you know, they're celibate and sober. And so what are they going to spend their downtime on, right? They're going to go help various different people, maybe feed the homeless, you know.
Volunteer at the orphanage, that kind of shit.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
That's so boring.
It is boring, but I mean, like, I'm trying to think of something for all characters, right? Yeah, like, we got plenty of stuff for, you know, the getting rowdy people, right? Crime, carousing, spreading rumors, all that stuff, right? So what about the people who want to play, you know, the penultimate good character? Yeah. What do they have for their downtime?
Well, yeah. I would argue that because there's no payoff, the only thing you need are rolls for success or failure. And that already exists with your skill checks. But go ahead, Casey. I was just gonna say, like, it's gonna be character specific, like circumstance specific, right?
And something like that could play into the carousing in terms of gaining favors. So you're doing good and you gain favors from allied like NPCs and contacts in those circles because you're doing good and you're just donating your time and investing your time. And so you can build relationships and allies that way.
Or you're giving those, you are gaining the favors, but you are doing it on behalf of an organization. So the orphanage or the soup kitchen or whatever is the one gaining those favors. You're not.
Yes, that is a very generous, good thing to do as a player.
Interesting. Like giving them your renown that you would normally make.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Like, this is not about me. I'm doing this for the orphanage or whatever. They reap the benefits of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Or like, you know, you get rather than having one benefit, right? Rather than you getting gold or you getting renown, you get half in a bunch of different things, right? Like, let's say you get one favor from someone who's on the street, right? You also get one renown from the farmers in town and then one something else, right?
Yeah.
One rumor or something like that.
The one mechanic that I don't see here, and I'm going to be honest, I'm glad it's not here. It's wrong to codify this, but I've seen it in other games and other editions, and it's something that I think people would... I've had players say, okay, so how does this work mechanically? Is the romance side of downtime? Because there's always the romance side of downtime. And I had to come up with a mechanic when I was DMing for Jamie, because he thought that if he just rolled a high enough persuasion check, he could get his fuck on. And I said, no, these are complicated people. These are real characters. This is not a power fantasy for you. You are going to have to adjust their attitudes and perspectives and whatnot through actual fucking work, and roles is going to take time. And like, he went from being, I'm going to fuck everything in the bar, to having a long-term relationship and getting engaged and having a baby, like, because we made rules for it. And he wanted this one NPC to be his girlfriend now. And he's like, okay. And that changed his mechanic. I did it again for Dan, and he rolled so well. He ended up with two dwarven girlfriends very briefly in the last campaign, which was wild. But like, I have seen it, and I tend to go respectable with it, but it is something I'm glad is not codified. Something I think players might look for, or DMs might say, hey, there's no rules for how to fall in love in D&D. And I'm like, yeah, because that's reductive as shit, and we shouldn't do that kind of thing to human beings. So especially with the stereotypical, historically accurate D&D player should not be codifying how to talk to women. That's not what these basement dwelling mouth breathers need to fucking do. I mean, look, I love you all listening to this, but we know the reputation back from the 80s and 90s, and it still holds true to some degree. Like, I'm glad we don't have the book of what was it? The Book of Erotic Fantasy from third edition.
Oh God.
Oh fuck. Yeah. I've got a PDF of it now and it is wrong. It is problematic on many. They did everything in their power to try to bring positive light to how this kind of thing would be. How do you handle sex in Dungeons and Dragons? We're going to be respectful. And we're going to be honest, we're going to talk about it like adults. But it was in the early 90s. And so it's like what it considers like deviant acts and shit is so problematic. It is just, it's a wild fucking ride. No one should look into that. And I'm glad it's not included in these books.
Why did you bring it up?
Because
nobody should look into this. But let me tell you about it first.
Yeah, no, but like, because people will look for it. This is a thing that's been kind of around in the past. And I noticed it was lacking on the list, and that's okay. Mm. So it is clearly missing from the list. So also,
missing on the list. Another thing that is missing on the list that is good that is missing on the list is inciting a riot.
Yeah, I feel like between carousing and sowing rumors, you might be able to get there pretty quickly.
Yeah, but I think there's a jump between spreading rumors and inciting mass rioting. You know, like you're gonna have to spend 66 weeks.
I think it needs to be more like that. if you are launching a revolution or a rebellion. That's going to be more in depth than one mechanic that you roll for two or three rolls. Now what you've done is cause civil unrest and people are flipping carts and lighting them on fire because of the Canucks lost.
Anyway, that's all for our discussion on downtime. Please take a second to engage with a like, follow, comment, and review to help push our engagement. And don't forget to subscribe to find future inspirations for your campaigns.
If you'd like to support us, we have a store with some merch and a donate button on our website, itsamimic.com, as well as a Patreon. This episode and others can also be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and most other podcast apps. Thanks for listening to It's a Mimic, where you never know what you're going to get.
Oh, but you are going to hear curious
about sex books in D&D.
This has been an It's a Mimic production. Please check the show notes for this episode to see links, time codes, and credits, and don't forget to reach out and share your own inspirations.
Yeah, you know what? When you brought that up, I was just curious. I was like, I wonder. And I typed D&DM and it automatically brought up D&D mating chart. So apparently it's how all of them can interbreed.
Oh, God.
All the races can interbreed and stuff.
But yeah, that's been codified. And like the most, I have seen this chart, the most prolific races that can intermingle are humans, orcs, and dragons. They got pretty good lists with everything. That's why we have half dragons. And that's why we have humans that are, like, if you have a half dwarf or a half elf or a half whatever, it's always with a human. You never have a half dragonborn, half tiefling, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yep, it's wild what all the perverts on the internet can do.
Yeah. Some people have just too much free time on their hands.
That's not the only thing that's on their hands, if I'm reading this correctly, so.
Hi-yo.
Ow. So, Casey, how long are you going to be polite about it? Kyle has no idea what we're talking about. You keep saying Cassie instead of Casey.
Oh shit. Sorry.
Fine. It's because you read it all the time. People who read my name all the time. That's what happens.
I have seen your name spelled this way once before, and it was Cassie for that girl. And I'm like,
yeah, thanks, right, ma'am. So. Thank you, parents, for a lifelong challenge.
It's just my accent. That's why I got it wrong.
All those bastards from the North Shore with their fucking accents.
Yeah, that's right.
See you next Tuesday.